Welcome to The Insurance Lawyer, the podcast where we discuss topics concerning lawsuits between insurance companies and their policyholders. I am your host, Evan Schwartz, founding partner of Schwartz, Conroy & Hack. Our firm represents business and individual insurance policyholders in claims and lawsuits against their insurance companies, helping policyholders get their claims paid. In today's episode, I'm really happy to introduce to you Richard Doobie from Doobie Law. I'll talk about him a bit first from a professional perspective and then from a personal perspective. Rich Doobie is a CPA and the founder of the law offices of Rich Doobie PC, a litigation law firm specializing in catastrophic injury and professional malpractice litigation, as well as contested estates, no-fault insurance litigation, and some complex corporate and commercial litigation. Rich has represented major corporations on various transactions and as litigants, both as plaintiffs and defendants. As a noted trial attorney, Mr. Doobie serves as trial counsel to many prominent law firms in New York, including working as of counsel to my firm, Schwartz, Conroy & Hack. Mr. Doobie has successfully litigated cases through trial and obtained verdicts in both state and federal courts in New York. Mr. Doobie has successfully argued cases in both the New York State and federal appellate courts. Mr. Doobie is of counsel relationships with many law firms and a roster of domestic and international clients. Known by his friends and clients as the legal assassin, he zealously represents his clients to ensure justice is served and a just result is achieved. On a personal note, Rich and I went to law school together, met in law school, studied during many, many classes or exams, and have been good friends and colleagues. We've tried cases together. We've co-counseled on cases together. And as I said earlier, he's of counsel to my law firm. And I'm just pleased to have a conversation with Rich, which I think will benefit everyone, but a joy for me to just talk to Rich about legal issues, which we do frequently. Rich, glad to have you here.
Thanks, Evan. Good morning. Thanks for having me.
So let's get into a couple of things. We're going to focus today on your personal injury practice, which I know you have had extensive experience in the personal injury world. And I'd like to start by asking you what the trends are that you see in your practice as a personal injury lawyer these days.
Sure. So personal injury on the plaintiff side is the bulk of my practice. I would say at this point, it's 85% of my practice. And before I go into the trends, just for the listeners, when they hear personal injury, I just want to give them a feel of the scope and the breadth of what that means. It's not just motor vehicle accidents, which is your garden variety automobile accident. It could be an accident with a truck. It could be accidents with a motorcycle. There could be multi-vehicle accidents. There's also trip and fall or slip and fall cases if there's a defect. There's a whole array of professional malpractice claims, not just medical or dental mal, but accounting malpractice, legal malpractice, architect or engineer malpractice. Any type of licensed professions can make errors, and that opens them up to professional malpractice claims. There's also construction site accidents where workers fall off a scaffold or down an elevator shaft, anything falling from a height. Sometimes shoppers and stores have a foreign object fall on them. I've handled many cases where they're walking down the aisles at Costco or Home Depot, as an example, and a box gets dislodged and collapses and falls on the customers. There's a host of workplace injuries. Now, if someone gets hurt on the job, that falls under the heading of workers' compensation. But where I come in, or any PI attorney, is if there's a third-party claim. So, for example, a person walks in an office building and trips on a mat or a wet floor, that would give rise to a third-party claim, perhaps the maintenance company who's responsible for the floors and the matting. So that's the broad spectrum of personal injury. In terms of trends, it's a great question, Evan. What I'm seeing now, I'm seeing more and more use of social media where the defendant attorneys and the insurance carriers will scour social media and go back way back when, 3-5 years, and it's discoverable. And they'll look to see what the injured person is posting, what activities they're in. I had one case where we always tell our clients, just don't post things on social media. You know, it's kind of like when you're driving, as if there's a cop behind you, you're not likely to speed. You should have that similar mindset with social media. I was close to settling a fractured leg case, and my client was claiming that he was badly injured. even had a lost earnings component to his business, and they produced pictures of him from social media playing beach volleyball, which I had no idea. He never told us. Needless to say, the value of his case went way down with that revelation. So I see more and more use of social media. I'm seeing an increase in claims where people are attaching an emotional component, emotional damage, PTSD, post-traumatic stress disorder, or anxiety, any emotional component. I'm seeing more and more of that weaved into the case. And I can tell you from my experience from 34 years representing injured people, those claims are quite real and very, very uncomfortable for them. And it becomes a very big challenge for them to manage their emotional state.
I can tell you that it's interesting you talk about the social media component, because that has become standard fare for lawyers representing clients, adversaries going after clients. We are in a world of publicly available information about each other, and people have become less and less concerned about their privacy or less and less protective of their privacy. And it just opens up a world of information that I think all litigants, not the least of which are personal injury litigants, need to be aware of.
Yeah, no, absolutely. And I use it too. We'll comb through the social media of a defendant and see what's going on there. And sometimes there's gold in them there, Hills.
Yep.
But I'm also seeing, as you know, with medical and insurance fraud cases, I know that's a big practice area with you. Where I see that in my personal injury world is the carriers now almost have this foggy lens that they look at a case and they're already suspect. They question the legitimacy of the claim. They question every facet of the injuries claimed. They comb through the medical bills that are submitted, you know, and that's a bit of an overlap practice that you and I have in the no-fault arena. But needless to say, the plaintiffs face considerable headwinds now. And the last trend I want to talk about is I'm seeing lower verdicts, oddly. And it's, I don't know if it's that jurors just have litigation fatigue or society has become too litigious for everybody's appetite. Most jurors try to talk themselves off of jury duty. But I'm seeing in all the different counties here in New York, where I practice in all of them, lower verdicts. And if there's an occasional high verdict, the defendants or the loser takes it up on appeal and the appellate division usually reduces it. So I'm seeing lower verdicts, which is somewhat troubling. But the unintended consequence of that is now there's an increase in mediations and arbitrations. We lawyers refer to that as alternative dispute resolution. I happen to love mediations. I think it creates an environment where you can really have a frank discussion off the record with the attorney and the adjuster, and we can both sides can kick the tires on the case and navigate an exit strategy. How can both sides manage risk and work out a negotiated settlement? And a settled case now with the vagaries of jury verdicts is the best outcome. And it creates a ceiling and a floor to the negotiations. And even if a mediation impasses and we don't settle it, very often the cases will settle shortly thereafter. So I'm seeing a big increase in mediations as well, which is a great, great benefit to our practice.
Well, I'll tell you, mediation is valuable. And my experience in it as well is that it's helpful. A lot of times, if you have a third party payer, meaning an insurance company, that's going to be contributing, and even if you don't, but particularly the third party payers, when you have a scheduled mediation, it forces the person that is the insurance company representative to focus on your matter to the exclusion of everything else. Because these days, most of these claims adjusters are the people that are handling these third party claims. They have too many matters on their plate, and you just can't get them to pay attention and spend the time and the energy and the focus that they need in order to just pay attention to your client's case.
Right. And the carriers benefit by closing files. The adjuster, they need to. So we need each other. That's very, very accurate what you're saying. And very often when we do these mediations, we do a lot of them by Zoom lately. And the adjusters can see a face, so I can put a face to the name, and vice versa. We assess each other's credibility and, you know, just in communication skills. And they say, okay, she understands the case or he understands the case. Let's keep it real. And when both sides keep it real, we can usually navigate an outcome that both sides can live with.
That's good. Anything that you're seeing, I'll call it long COVID. So not only long COVID as an illness, but the lingering effects of COVID on the court system. Anything there?
Well, during COVID, a lot of the statutes of limitations and the filing deadlines were extended. So that helped. And it changed the way we all practice. I used to go to court and I would have to make personal appearances. And now a lot of it is done by Zooms, or the courts use Teams, which is a similar type of video conferencing. And I can conference a case out in Riverhead at 9:30 in the morning and conference a case in Lower Manhattan at 11 o'clock, and I haven't left my desk. So COVID has really helped the plaintiff's attorneys become much more efficient, because we can handle more cases without being bogged down and sitting in traffic. So that's been a big help. But now the courts are starting to populate again, like here in Nassau, where my main office is. Most of the conferences are in person now, as opposed to remote.
So even the most basic conferences.
Yes, even the most basic. And we lose that efficiency because it is much more efficient. But many of the counties still, like on a preliminary conference, they'll allow the lawyers to submit a proposed PC order, which outlines the discovery. And if both sides agree, the courts stamp it and it avoids an appearance. I'm in great favor of that because I think the courts are clogged up enough. So anything that keeps the wheels moving, I'm in favor of.
Okay. So there's so much personal injury noise in the world. So much advertising, social media, television, radio, everywhere you turn, there's somebody promoting some type of injury case. So how do you, as a prospective client or someone who is being asked by a prospective client, how do you sift through that noise? What should clients be looking for in a personal injury lawyer? And how do you distinguish yourself from the rest of the pack?
Yeah, so that's a challenge that I have faced for 34 years because I don't do any advertising. I've built my practice strictly through word of mouth. And I'm competing against the firms, the big firms that are really marketing firms now that spend, you know, seven figures a month, and they flood television and radio and billboard signs and bus stop signs. They're everywhere. So unless the layperson has a relationship with a law firm, they're going to look and they're going to call the brightest and most colorful sign. So a guy like me doesn't stand a chance, typically. You know, I'm not even the minnow. I'm like plankton in the ocean with these big firms. So what I've done is my network of people, clients refer other clients, colleagues refer. I'm a retired CPA. I have people from my old accounting world and those clients and employees. So I have my own network of people that will call me, and typically they're happy they did. Because when they come to my firm, they deal with me. They're not dealing with a low-level associate. They're dealing with me. And that hands-on approach gives them the comfort that they want. And being a trial attorney, it gives me an advantage where I can bite. I don't necessarily just bark. And there are some cases that just need to be tried. And now if I go to trial, I've done something wrong. That means I failed to sell my case to the other side and I failed to get it resolved. But there are some cases that we're never going to resolve it and we just need the courts. And so when we go to trial, and that will yield more and more attention because there's a small percentage of lawyers that actually go to trial. So being a trial attorney, I think, is one of the distinguishing features for me. But yeah, I can't compete with the big firms, but I can.
Not from a marketing perspective.
Not from a marketing, correct.
But that doesn't mean, because they have a lot of money to spend, doesn't necessarily mean that they're the firm for some prospective client to go to.
Oh, this is absolutely true. In fact, at the risk of sounding immodest, I would rank my skills against anybody, against any firm, any senior partner or battery of associates. I could care less.
What about the argument that there's, well, you got to go to a big firm, you know, because they have resources that you won't have. What's the response to that?
So I guess that's the perception. But in terms of resources, my firm lays out money for experts and for demonstrative evidence. You know, I had one case where we used an animation firm to do recreation based on time, space, and distance of how the motor vehicle accident happened. And we did our version, and then we did a presentation of the defendant's version to show how unrealistic the defendant's version would be. And sometimes the use of animation is the final straw that breaks the camel's back. It's the final bit of demonstrative evidence that helps. And I spare no expense on a case. If we need an expert, we'll retain the most qualified expert, regardless of what their fees are. So I don't necessarily hold with that. I think sometimes the client's needs are a better service with a boutique firm. And I can tell you that I have gone against multiple defendants. There's been sometimes cases where there's been five attorneys against me with all their firms, and we prevail and everyone shakes hands afterwards. And at no time did the client feel they were underrepresented. In fact, they were like, thank goodness, Rich, you were on the case. So that's a great, great feeling for me.
Good. Can you share a story about an interesting case? Because all these podcasts, when you talk to lawyers, you hear a lot of generalities, but well, if you have a case in mind that you could tell us a little story about that was complicated or interesting, that's worth sharing.
There's one that looks like it could be a law school fact pattern, and I literally just got the final piece settled the end of the year, just a few weeks ago in late December. I had a young man that was part-time working as an Uber driver, and he picked up a fare on late Friday night, early into Saturday morning, and the two occupants were clearly lit up. They were clearly, they had a few drinks. And a dispute arose in the car. There was a dispute about credit card use versus cash. The passengers thought that my client, the driver, was trying to rip them off by saying, hey, if you pay me in cash, you don't have to charge the credit card, when their understanding was that with Uber, it automatically charges the credit card. My driver, on the other hand, thought that he was being set up for mugging. They were trying to size him up with how much cash he had on him. So needless to say, there was a conflict. Both sides reacted poorly. And next thing you know, a fist fight ensues in the back of the car. The two passengers, who were considerably larger than my driver, started punching him and hitting him. One guy gets out of the car. They drag him out. They're kicking. They beat the pulp out of him. Kicked him in the eye, kicked him in the ribs. There was an off-duty security officer, actually an on-duty security officer at a nearby hospital, who heard the ruckus, saw it, began honking his horns and say, hey, I called the police, leave him alone. My client then, with his hands up in a surrender position, said, hey guys, you got me good. He backs up into the street, attempting to get back into his car, and an oncoming van blocked him and hit him. The police came. The two assailants that were in the car were arrested. They pled guilty to an assault. It was reduced to a disorderly conduct, but they allocated and they told the court they beat my guy and stomped my guy. My kid was in the hospital for a couple of months, had broken bones, dreadful life-threatening injuries. He comes to my office and the first thing I'm looking for is, okay, wow, what a fact pattern. Okay, how do I unpack this? Who do I sue? Well, okay, you were an Uber driver, so technically you're on the job, that's workers' comp, although the beating happened outside the car mostly. So then maybe that's not workers' comp. Do you have auto insurance? He says, yeah, I had a Geico policy, but it lapsed. He didn't pay the premium. So now he didn't have insurance. And then the van that hit him fled. It was a hit and run. So, and then I'm thinking, well, the assailants intentionally beat the guy, so there's no coverage typically for intentional torts. So I'm stewing about it, and I asked if he lives with his parents. Turns out he lives with his parents, and he's a member of the household, and the parents had a big uninsured motorist policy, so I was able to trigger coverage for the hit-and-run portion there. So the first level was, how do I deal with the tortfeasors? One of them had a homeowner's policy, and they disclaimed. They said, sorry, it's an intentional tort. There's no coverage. So I called the adjuster and they put me with the senior claims risk department. And I said, you guys are looking at the case incorrectly. I'm not suing for the intentional battery, if you will. I'm suing for negligently and recklessly chasing my client into the street where he got hit by an oncoming van. And I was able to trigger coverage under the homeowner. The other bad guy didn't have insurance and we settled with him out of pocket. So I packaged with the two bad guys, if you will, leaving part two where I had to go after the uninsured motorist for the van. And that's the case that just resolved a few weeks ago. And we had some legal disputes. They were claiming they were entitled to an offset to offset the first tranche of monies that I got. I said, no, they're not entitled to it. Ultimately, we went to mediation and we got that resolved. But to me, that was not just because it would just happen just a few weeks ago, but that was one of the more interesting cases because I had to figure out how to get coverage. In a personal injury, you need the trifecta. You need coverage, good injuries, and clear liability. Here, I didn't have clear coverage. I didn't have clear liability, but I had great injuries. So right. I was able to navigate. So to me, that was just a, you know, just a tremendous outcome. Client was thrilled.
It does sound like a law school hypothetical, and I appreciate you sharing that story. And yeah. I knew a little bit about it. And even though we didn't talk about it in advance, I hope that was the one you were going to talk about.
Yeah. No, it was not crazy.
I love it. All right. On another note, do you see and come into contact in your practice when, you know, you just talked about the problems in getting coverage and you just explained how you got around an intentional act exclusion claim by an insurance company saying, hey, we weren't going to cover you for the beating. And you were saying, this isn't about the beating. This is the negligently causing him to step into an oncoming car. So that leads me to the question of, are there typical coverage problems that you see in your practice with the defendants that you've got to deal with?
Absolutely. Absolutely. I've handled mold cases. Now, mold cases, we refer to them as a sick building case, usually with apartment buildings, residential apartment buildings. And when black mold comes in, it's very pervasive. It gets into the sheetrock. It gets into the piping. It thrives in that damp, dark environment and spreads. And then it seeps through the occupants' bedrooms and bathrooms and living rooms in their apartments. When they're exposed, when occupants are exposed to mold, often these are airborne pathogens that give them respiratory distress and all types of physical injuries from mold. Well, when they come to me and I bring the claim against the property owner, very often their policies will have a mold exclusion. So there's expressly omitted. It's excluded. There's no coverage for that. So that's a challenge. So before we take mold cases, we have to analyze those policies to look for the mold exclusions because carriers will do everything they can to disclaim coverage. As you well know, that's your world better than mine. So that's a problem where there's no coverage. Another problem I see is if there's no notice provided or late notice. Most insureds have an obligation to notify their carrier of a claim so that the carrier has time to investigate and defend it. And if the carrier is deprived of such an opportunity, they could disclaim saying, sorry, Mr. Insured, even though you paid the premium and even though you would have been covered, you didn't tell us in time. So we're going to disclaim due to lack of notice. Another area we see if there's a municipal defendant, a town, a city, a state, county, where we have a certain number of days prescribed by law to place them on notice by filing a notice of claim. I had one case where there was a two-car collision and my client was a little old lady and she wasn't litigious, but she wasn't recovering from her injuries. She got sued by the other driver, turned it over to her insurance company for her own defense, and she was still had nagging back and neck injuries, went for a further orthopedic. They sent her to for MRIs, and it revealed that she had fractures, compression fractures in her thoracic spine, her mid-spine. Then and only then did she seek an attorney, and she came to me. So by the time she came to me, it was about a year after the accident. I filed a notice of claim against New York City in this instance because both motorists claimed they had the green light and the police were saying there's something wrong with this traffic device. You're opening up the city. The city moved to dismiss saying, sorry, you didn't give us notice in time. You had 90 days and you didn't give us notice. I had to make a motion for a late notice of claim and I pointed to the other vehicle who timely notified them. And I said, look, court, there's no prejudice here. Driver A filed the notice of claim timely with New York City. I'm driver B in the other car. The city already hadn't had time to adequately investigate the claim. So in that case, the court allowed our late notice. So my case survived. But those are some of the challenges when there's notice issues or when there's exclusions and coverage. So that's why a lot of times we take cases subject to investigation because we want to make sure that there's coverage. Without coverage, it's a very difficult ride uphill, very, very hard to collect. And ultimately, if we hit for a big number, they could file bankruptcy and discharge us. So we wouldn't collect anyway. So part of my role to sanitize a claim and protect my client is to make sure that there's a pot at the end of the rainbow. So those are some of the challenges with coverage.
All right. That's wonderful. I appreciate that. So I know you have a well-established practice in New York. You've been practicing for a very long time. But I also know that you're licensed in Florida and you've built a practice in Florida. What's happening in Florida these days?
Sure. So, well, I took the Florida bar in 1990, right after the New York bar, and I always filed inactive. But a number of years ago, I started to pick up some personal injury cases in Florida, and I opened up an office in Boca Raton with a high school friend of mine, Ron Zagarin, and Ron and I partner up on my overlap cases in Florida. Florida has different rules, similar but different. One example is in a motor vehicle accident. Here in New York, there's a 3-year statute of limitations, whereas in Florida, there's a 2-year. That means you have to start a lawsuit within 2 years. So you have to be a little bit, it's a shorter timeline. So there's some procedural and substantive differences, but by and large, it's the same concepts, the same no-fault benefits paid and the same methodology to get cases resolved. And I'm now building up more and more of my Florida presence. There's a tremendous overlap with New Yorkers and Floridians back and forth, especially in an aging community. My mom and dad are selling their house, they're retiring, and they're buying other businesses. We do. I help them with the transactions. I help them with their estate planning. Some of my counsel specialize in estate planning and, asset protection and things like that. So there's a great opportunity with New York, Florida overlap. So I get called very often and I get consulted, and I'm, very, very gratuitous when it comes to consultations. People can email me, hey, Rich, I got your name from so-and-so. And if there's a case, I'll find it. And if I can't handle it, I have a network of colleagues that I can place them in good hands if I can't handle it or if it's not my practice area. But in terms of Florida and New York, tremendous overlap there.
Awesome. Well, listen, I can speak to say that, yes, if there's a case to be found, Rich will find it. And if there's extra money to be squeezed out of a defendant, Rich will squeeze it. I can speak in a testimonial fashion on Rich's behalf, having known him all these years, being a dear friend and an excellent colleague. And I can't thank you enough for joining me today. I really appreciate you being here. Thank you.
Yeah, thanks, Evan. And if anyone needs to reach me ever, I'll just give you my email address. It's rdubi, R-D-U-B-I, at dubilaw.com. And I'll be happy to help anyone from your world.
Awesome. Well, before we go, if you like this episode, please subscribe so you don't miss out on any new episodes we have coming. You can visit our website at www.schlawpc.com, www.schlawpc.com for more information. Thank you so very much for coming to listen to the Insurance Lawyer Podcast, and I'll see you on the next episode soon. Take care.